This is Charlie. And Kelly, you're there, right?
I'm here.
You know what? The sound is, I'm going to take my headphone off and use my regular phone because it's not loud enough. Just a second.
You know, Charlie, it could have been mine. How's this?
Hello?
Hey, Charlie, how's this? Better?
Yeah, that's better. I just have a crummy headphone.
I'd have been mine, too. I switched. Okay, great.
Yeah, you had the same problem I did getting access.
Yep, got the written number here just a second ago. And
yeah.
Ready to roll. I'm quite interested in this topic and to hear what you were thinking about.
Yeah. Well, this is different than some of the ones we've done because we haven't talked a bit about it. So it just, I was realizing when I prepare for these, I try to organize my thinking about it and just go different directions, and then I wonder totally what you're doing because I'm assuming it's a totally different direction.
Let's hope.
Do you want to start or do you want me to start?
I'd love it if you start. I do have quite a few different thoughts, and it was really interesting. So maybe if you start, then you can lay out the topic too.
Well, I'll lay out here's my thoughts about it. I mean, I proposed this title, and I mean, it's interesting to me that I didn't think of it then, but here we are talking tonight, and there's a turning point in my own life because I just, day before yesterday, did my last behavioral tech workshop, and now I'm a free agent, so to speak, plan to do just as much training and consultation, but doing it, you know, in a variety of ways and with different formats and different people. And so it's a big change for me after about 14 years. So it's been a real turning point. So that's been on my mind now. But let me try to tell you what I meant when I said turning points, because there's such – I mean, it could mean so many different things.
Mm-hmm.
I was thinking that what I've really been interested in is when somebody undergoes some kind of meaningful transformation in their life. It could be big, it could be small, but it's where there is a discrete, you know, there is a discrete shift in some direction. And then when I have a certain idea of what I meant, but then I realized, well, that could be a lot of things.
Mm-hmm.
So one type of thing it could be is there's a lot of turning points when I think about my own life and people I know or patients I've worked with or all kinds of things that are basically externally driven. You know, there's a move. When I was in seventh grade, we moved from the small town to the big city in Oregon, and it totally changed my life. But so that was a huge turning point, but it's like the kind of turning point that was not as a result of growth on my part or tensions or resolution of anything. It's just there I was. And then it did lead to changes. So there is that kind of turning point, losses, moves, big changes that sort of happen to you. And there's even winning the lottery would be one of those. And then there's another group, and that isn't the group that I meant, even though I'm interested in that. How do people adjust to externally driven turning points? But a second, there's this another group I was realizing when I was thinking about tonight that are all those things that we do where we make a discrete change, but actually the function of it is to relieve tension or to get out of something, to move on because, you know, we're escaping. And it isn't necessarily, I mean, it might actually be a good thing and it might be growth-inducing, but it also wasn't exactly what I meant, though it's closer to it. So the thing that I meant was, bear with me for a minute, because this is in my mind and I haven't tried to articulate this. It's like this. It's the way I think about how these things come about is that the kind of turning points that I was meaning are the ones that come about because you've made a series of choices in your life. You've chosen a person, you've chosen a friend, you've chosen a house, you've chosen a place to live, you've chosen a job, you've chosen to do this or that. And one choice leads to another, which leads to another, which leads to another. And you gradually define a trajectory and a set of things that happen on a regular basis. And you live in a way within those choices in an ongoing way. And I started thinking metaphorically, it'd be like, you know, you're in a good-sized, large-diameter tunnel, and you're walking your way down, and a lot of things are defined by what you made decisions about in the past few years or maybe even yesterday. So you're going down this tunnel. This could be the tunnel of the relationship you're in your partnership or marriage or whatever, or it could be your relationship with your dog. It could be the tunnel of the job that you're in or something else about your life. And as you go along, I think for most people, over time, you make adjustments. You have some points where you get hurt. You have points where you get disappointed. You have things happen that you weren't intending. All kinds of little things, sometimes big things, to the point where actually the diameter of the tunnel gets narrower. And you're going along and you're realizing, oh, it's a little narrower there, but it's still big enough. And you make accommodations and you do this and you do that, and it's workable. It isn't where you first intended to be, but it's actually workable. It's a set of compromises and you're going along. And I think most of us live one way or another. We get into these trajectories. And then I think sometimes the tunnel gets narrower to the point where you start to become aware, this is uncomfortable. This is challenging. You start to become aware that there's maybe some kind of a mismatch between yourself and the previous choices you've made. And it might be a mild one or a moderate one, but there's some degree of mismatch, and it's growing on you that now, you know, this doesn't feel quite the way I want it to be. And then I think it might not quite reach crisis proportions there, but actually if you keep going down that same tunnel without making any adjustments, that same trajectory, you might end up where it kind of feels like a crisis situation. You follow me so far?
Yeah, I'm liking the metaphor.
Yeah. Well, and then, you know, for instance, I'm thinking of a young man I worked with a long time ago who left college, was slated for a career, had been for years, moved into that career, lucrative career, family-supported career, made a lot of people happy. It's going along well, but he comes to see me because he was having the first depression of his life. And as we talk for a few weeks, it becomes clear that even though he's really successful at what he's doing, he's in one of those tunnels. That a mismatch had grown to where he actually was, you know, performing, doing well, getting a lot of external reinforcement, but he was getting demoralized. He was kind of alienated from what he was doing, and there was this mismatch between him and the walls. And so, it was growing to crisis proportions where he didn't want to go to work, and so, and he was still a very young man, just 1 year out of college. So we talked, and the best thing that we did eventually within the next 2 or 3 months was started letting him wander in his conversation with me about, you know, how he ended up with that choice, that particular set of walls, and what other things he gave up to do that, and how he thought of himself, and where did that come from. And it got to the point where, you know, he started to say, what I really like to do is be outside. I said, well, a lot of people like to be outside, but so let me hear more about this. And he really thought, I really like camping. I like hiking. I mean, when he was 17, he hiked the whole Appalachian Trail, and he loved it. And he thought, wouldn't he be happy if he was out somehow doing that kind of thing? Long story short, he made some disruptive moves right there, but it was the kind of turning point that I'm talking about, because it grew out of an awareness of a mismatch and a set of tensions, and he made a decision to stop working there, and it was a big deal for him and standing up to his family, and he went to work in an outdoors job. I won't say anything more identifying than that, and he moved along, and he absolutely loved it. And I hear from him every once in a while. It's been probably, I don't know, between 15 and 20 years probably, and he writes me every year or two, and he just feels he made this right choice. Other things have come up that have been difficult, but that's the kind of thing I mean. Okay.
That's really interesting. What a great metaphor.
I read it somewhere. I can't take credit for this metaphor. I just don't remember where it came from. But I like most metaphors. It started somewhere else, but I do like it, and I own it now. I'm renting it. I'm renting this metaphor. But one more, I'll say one more thing, and then let me hear where this goes for you, because I think when you get in those types of situations where you realize that there's a mismatch in your life, or the walls have gotten narrower and it's getting tougher, I think that as I kind of tried to go let my mind figure out all the different ways people go with these things, I came up with like three big groups of ways people go. The first ones I'll call explosions. And I think it's where there's either an explosion of some kind, psychologically, developmentally, with some choice, you know, somebody, you know, has seemed happy in a marriage and then they up and leave. This happened to a relative of mine, that her husband, one day, when she said, "Are you grumpy? You seem grumpy today." And he said, "Yeah, I am. Do you want to know why?" And then he just all of a sudden just spewed out that he wanted out. And he left. That's an explosion. I think there, explosions also can be interruptions. They're disruptive. They are forms of escape. They're ways to deal with pressure. They're one big jump. And so I think there's that way to cope with being in that tunnel. And I think sometimes people do a few of those, but then they settle into a sort of a chronic pattern of like half explosions. So let's say someone doesn't move out, but they start having a chronic, a long distance or long term affair to cope with that they weren't happy in their marriage, or they do something because of their job, or they start drinking, or they start doing other behaviors like that, that kind of have one foot in and one foot out of the tunnel. So you're in the tunnel, but then you go off in another tunnel, but it's not really integrated.
Mm-hmm.
So that's all number one. I think there's a lot of that. Then I think number two I'll call implosions. And implosions, I think, is another common category where when people get to this point and they don't feel they can get out and they have trouble going on and they're not the explosive type, they implode. So they develop symptoms. They develop anxiety disorders. They develop depressions. They develop somatic, you know, medical problems, and things like that really become preoccupying, and they don't really get you out of the tunnel, but at the moment they sort of are representations of implosions, and you take care of them, but it doesn't move you forward with respect to the tunnel, so it doesn't really, it also doesn't get anything integrated. And there are chronic patterns of that where maybe you don't have dramatic symptoms at the moment, but you have low energy, you have tiredness that might be partly driven by this, and you're just kind of like, you're a little bit resigned to your life and your fate. And then I think the third category is what I'm really looking for in myself, in people close to me, or in my patients, is to catalyze at those points some way where you take stock and you make efforts, and you maybe do some trial experiments, and you talk to other people, and you widen your awareness, and you might not even do all this consciously, but somehow you widen the tunnel, or you develop a new pathway, another tunnel comes off of that tunnel. So you're still where you are, but you transform something. You do something different, either in a relationship, in a job, or alongside a relationship or a job, but in a way that actually allows you to get more space. And then, so that's, you know, a lot said to begin this talk, because I just wanted to get that whole thing out. I have a lot of personal associations with this that I could get back to, one big example, but I'd rather just kind of leave it out there and see kind of what you know, how you take this in.
That's really interesting. It's a different direction than I, when I, some of my thinking went the same direction, and that's where I'll stay, and then I had a whole other tributary that went off a different direction. But to stay with what you were just saying, this last point you were saying, this option three of catalyzing, and whether consciously or unconsciously, sort of figuring out what to do with this constriction of the tunnel. That is really interesting to me. So maybe we could work with that for a bit.
But I definitely want to hear your other tributary, because I knew you'd go a different direction. There's no reason I would. There's no reason I would think you would go this direction. This is very internal direction, kind of.
Yeah. Well, so one thought just on this catalyzing.
Yeah.
Because one of the things I was thinking does fit really nicely with that is, there's this relational meditation practice called Insight Dialogue. Dialogue by Gregory Kramer. It's that book. And one of the, this has a number of different meditation instructions that are given. And one of the ones that is really interesting and most useful is this, it's called Trust Emergence. And the idea in this is based in a Buddhist principle or understanding that change is continual, and that actually this idea of stability or non-change is delusion, and that in fact you can train your attention to watch this stream of everything that's arising and falling, the sensations, the thoughts, all of the external events, one's perceptions of those, in such a way where you become more sensitive. And what I was just thinking with your tunnel metaphor is there's some capacity, this ability to tolerate the distress of that constriction without just doing your old habit. Like I'm thinking of your option two of all these half explosions, these typical ways we temper or moderate distress.
Exactly.
That lets us keep one foot in.
Mm-hmm.
And those... with this meditation instruction, what you do is you learn by watching what are your habits, what do you do, and you learn to simply watch them without jumping, without imploding or exploding, but to watch and see if you can get kind of the hang of what your habits are, and then stay sensitive to what might be new or fresh or, but I'm just thinking of the type of skill you actually need to catalyze. Some of it is being sensitive enough to, I'm thinking really of being stuck in the tunnel, like where is the airflow? There's just a slight bit of airflow, like your guy when you were having the conversations where he's roaming around, like where is there some vitality? Where is there some energy? And you can, it takes quite a bit to be able to sense, like, there's a side route out of here,
Well, I think what I like about that is that I also think that if you stick with that metaphor, you're there in the tunnel. Usually, if you become aware, even thinking about it's a suffocating idea. I mean, it can make you anxious.
Mm-hmm.
The tunnel is narrowing. You're aware. Let's say it's in your life, and you're thinking, "Gee, things are worse now than 6 months ago," and really, you start to get maybe at least the mild level. The level there's a little frantic quality of, "Oh, what am I going to do?" And then you might start to see some of these implosions or explosions or chronic sort of, I don't know, adaptations that aren't so, aren't very, in the long run, aren't really getting you out. And then you get stuck in those. And I think what you're saying is that the idea would be the person at that point in the tunnel, if only they could believe that there is a way to stop, look, and listen, and just kind of like be there, and maybe with that, the idea being that kind of instruction with somebody, or maybe that's sort of what was going on with the young man that I treated for, a while with me, that just kind of like stopped at that point in the tunnel, and he had someone to talk to, and it catalyzed him considering how he got there, and what his options were, and he started to feel less stuck even before he made a move, because he was becoming more aware.
I think so it's this awareness.
What?
It's that ability to pause, relax at least enough to not do your habit, and then somehow open beyond that constricted attention, and then to somehow keep yourself in the moment of the actual pain of being constricted long enough for something new that's not just the old habit, the old response. I think you can train that ability, when DBT, the distress tolerance skills. But I also think some of the basic instructions that come out of a meditation practice can be extremely helpful.
Uh-huh.
It's really hard to be stuck in that particular way and not just do something that's completely driven by the trajectory thus far.
Well, because you're just constantly trying to relieve some pressure. It's just human at that point to do all these things. And, of course, you know, DBT, you end up seeing people who are relieving pressure in very destructive ways. And there are other people who are not, you know, who have maybe don't have BPD per se, but, you know, they have a lot of other ways to where they get stuck there. And but this is where I kind of group these together in this conversation. As that everybody is in that time. Well, sometimes if you're doing DBT or another treatment model with somebody with a severe disorder, after a few months of treatment, you yourself feel like you've gone down that tunnel. You're there too. You know, now the patient was there and you thought you were outside it, and now you're in it because every session this feels like you're trying to affect change and you can't, and you get stuck yourself and you start to feel a little bit burned out yourself, and then, of course, the idea is for you to start to use awareness. But yeah. I'm curious about those practices. I think I'm going to read that, because I know you told me about a retreat, and I wasn't able to go to it, about this kind of dialogue.
It's a set of meditation instructions. It's coming out of, Vipassana meditation tradition, insight meditation tradition. But the instructions are actually really nice. And I think it would, just to say the name of the book again, it's Insight Dialogue by Gregory Kramer.
Mm-hmm.
And this one, this trust emergence in particular, the ability to simply stay with what is happening, refraining. I think of it as almost a friend of mine was working on her habit of criticizing. So distress would come, and one of the ways she would co-construct the tunnel was criticism would just, you know, come flying out. And when she was working on this, she talked about fasting from criticism. And so
fasting,
literally she would
criticism, fasting.
Write on her lips, and she would reframe.
Uh-huh.
And in that inhibition, in that holding back or refraining from ill-tempered speech, there was a lot that could be watched if you could stay in that moment.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, you know, and then I think, if you can, this, a couple thoughts about this. I mean, sometimes people go to meditation retreats looking for this kind of, sort of a way to cope with the tunnel or to find a new way. And sometimes I've known people that do that, and then when they're there, it feels like another world, and it's very opening. And people get very, I think, moved by it, and their eyes are opened, and then they get back, and then they're back in the tunnel.
Yeah.
And it feels like they, you know, they need to go back to a meditation retreat. And it's sort of like, how do you bring those things? How do you get creative? How do you get determined or courageous in your life? Because these things are relentless. I mean, any of the ones I'm talking about, if you get down to it, I mean, if it's a relationship that's lasted years or a job you've been devoted to for years and you depend on, or all the other things that you practice, they're relentless once you're in them. And if they aren't working right, or if they're a mismatch, or it feels like a mismatch. So it does seem to me that the right thing to do, however you get there, is just like you were saying, to exercise some kind of, to resist doing things that you've begun to figure out are just more of the same. It's just sort of like you're appeasing yourself. You're finding rationalizations, or you're just finding tension relief, but you're staying basically in the same tunnel. And I think the first step is, because it's sort of hard to just think your way out of a tunnel like this.
Yeah.
And if you jump out of the tunnel, my experience of both seeing it and feeling it sometimes is, I don't think of that as a real transformation. I mean, it's sort of like old family therapy teaching about the more things change, the more they stay the same.
Yeah.
There is this kind of like rearranging the furniture on the Titanic or something, you know.
Titanic.
It's in the tunnel or in the coal mine or something. And so it doesn't do it. So the question is, how do you slow down what you're doing. Assume, okay, I'm going to keep doing this. I'm going to just keep slugging away at this, but I'm going to bring a new level of awareness to it.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to try to resist. It's basically like in anxiety treatment. I'm going to do response prevention. I'm going to prevent my escapes. I'm going to prevent myself from avoiding as much. But I'm going to just sort of stick with this, and I'm just going to like review things. You know, in another culture, a person might go off on a vision quest
mm-hmm.
at this point and really search for what are my values, what's my dreams, and find a way. But you're still there. So
yeah.
I think.
Yeah.
And to me, when we're talking about DBT, to me this completely overlaps with where dialectics comes in, because you're really looking for a new synthesis once you've been stuck. And you start to become aware of what you're stuck in and how you got there and how it keeps going. Then the question is not how do I bail out or how do I just, you know, stop this. It's kind of like how do I now work with what I've got
mm-hmm.
and rearrange in a meaningful way and find a new synthesis in my life, which then will maybe open the tunnel more and now open sort of new tributaries of experience. And so I think some form of dedicated insight practice, I think those make a lot of sense. Then I think sometimes it just takes the form of conversations with other people when the timing's right. That it's less of a deliberate practice, but that people find their way if they're surrounded by one or two good friends or a therapist.
Yeah. You know,
yeah.
The other thing, Charlie, that was making me think is the tunnel, the ones we've talked about so far, is the fit or the mismatch with one's circumstances.
Yeah.
The other that was really on my mind is the way in which self-definition, you know, the story we tell oneself, ourselves, where just thinking about the different ways we might end up in a very constricted self view, where the self is loathsome and victim-like, and all the other ways in which, you know, this trajectory, kind of where we didn't pick our parents, we didn't pick these circumstances, but the circumstances have shaped this very narrow, constricted, deadening sense of self that would also lead to this explosion, implosion, et cetera.
Uh-huh.
And and how you get out of that. It made me, so this is an exercise that comes out of acceptance and commitment therapy, but it made me think of the ways you can defuse or get some distance from this, you know, literal, I'm bad, or here's how my story is. And there's a really interesting exercise where you do your life events, you lay out all of your life events and tell your story, and then you go back and you pick out the significant events. You know, parents divorced, whatever are the different, you know, big things in your life, these key instances, or what we might be talking about as turning points, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
And then you rearrange them, or you tell a different story and keep the same events, but tell a different story about how you got there.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that there's something about doing that exercise. I've done it now several times with my same life events. That is really freeing because you
tell a different story.
Yeah.
You mean you have the same events that you have to explain, but you put them in a different story?
Yeah, exactly.
Hmm.
And there's something about it that is really freeing because you know, you do make it be coherent. That's just the nature, I think, of how our minds work. So you tell a coherent story, but and it's true also. It's just a really freeing exercise. This is one of the ones that I'd be glad to nab and share with Perry afterwards. But I think there's a certain way where our stories about ourselves, our stories about our lives, can also be a form of a tunnel, not just the external circumstances, but the stories we tell about the circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
What would be an example? I'm sort of trying to apply this.
Yeah, so let's say you know, if you take life events, I'm trying to think of how to do it without being too self-disclosing in this very instant, because I don't have a prepared...
Okay. Well, if you don't have one, it's all right. I mean, don't do it right now.
Yeah, I was going to say, we might end up with quite a long story and me crying profusely.
We'll just have to go past 9 o'clock. It's
somewhat.
All right.
Yeah,
well,
but
I do.
But this
yeah,
is
right.
one where I'll put the exercise out there and then I'll share some examples. How would that work?
Yeah.
Okay, cool.
You mean right now or you mean you'll put it out there?
I'll put it out there to Perry after this.
To Perry, and she could put it out, what, on her website, you mean?
Yeah, I'll find out with her. Sort of,
okay.
I've done that a couple times with her, sort of shared after the fact some of the things
okay.
that we've come up with, like book lists mm-hmm. and whatnot.
Kelly, it's Perry. I'm not clear on what you're suggesting you'll do. We'll do it. Just if I'm confused, I'm assuming other people might be as well.
Okay, so what I'm thinking is there's a really nice exercise just about this life story.
Mm-hmm.
Ways in which you can do it. And what I'll do is I'll get the instructions for the exercise and a little bit more rationale
mm-hmm.
and some examples and be able to share that.
Terrific. I'm enthralled about what you both are saying, so both on a professional and personal level. So I hope others are following it as well in the same way.
Okay, great.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me tell you one of the, when I started thinking about this, and I'm sort of thinking about the things you're saying, and maybe it might apply to the example I had. And this is a example for me of one of the, I think a real turning point for me, was in the course of being a teacher in DBT. And I don't mean the change that recently that I'm making, but this is goes back, I'd say, 5 to 7 to 8 years. There was a time after I had taught workshops for a lot of years and seminars and things that I found myself getting kind of like in a narrower tunnel about it. Like a workshop would be coming up, be thinking, oh no, I got to go back and go teach another workshop. And I would do a good job, and I think people would learn quite a bit, but my internal experience was increasingly, it was a little bit deadening. I felt at the beginning like I was just totally enthralled, enthusiastic, loving, figuring it out, teaching it as I did that, and I think it felt like a live event for me and a growth event. But now it was becoming like a repetition of the same stuff. I sort of have this wondering about how people who do plays like on Broadway for several years, how they go every night and again bring it alive because they must face something like this. And so I really started to think, you know, I don't think I'm going to keep doing this. And I started to really think about, well, I want to get out of this tunnel and get into something else. And around that, it was actually made worse by, you know, Cindy Sanderson dying and then not teaching with her anymore and losing a personal friend and going on and doing the teaching and teaching by myself, teaching with other people and all. And it was always really good to teach with other people because that really helped me with it. But there was still a fundamental problem. I couldn't name it. It seemed like there was a lot of good things going on. There was a certain moment when I was teaching and I was over in Sweden where I had this sort of transformative experience where in the middle of walking around teaching, suddenly I felt like Cindy was teaching with me.
Mm.
And it was a bizarre experience. It sort of came upon me. And I think it's partly because of something you said, Kelly, earlier, which is that rather than just stopping it when I felt like it, I just kept doing it. And I kept wondering about it. I kept trying to think, well, could I do it this way or could I do it that way? Because I really felt it was a valuable thing I was doing and it was something that meant a lot to me. But it was getting deadened. And one day when I was teaching and I felt like she was literally, it was probably the closest to a real psychotic experience that I've had where I felt like she was almost like talking while I was talking, which actually she used to do, now that I think of it. And I felt like she was like almost at the level of my chest, which would have been about her height. And I'm walking back and forth in front of this thing at the Karolinska Institute in Stockholm, and I'm talking, and I'm feeling like I'm losing my place because I feel like she's trying to talk through my chest. And I thought, shut up, you know. And then there was a moment where I just thought, you know what, this is fantastic. I love this. You know, we're teaching together again. And I felt like my teaching got, from then on, there was a new tributary in my teaching, which was I felt like I was also to some degree channeling who she was as I taught. I became a little looser, a little bit more outrageous, and a little bit, you know, like she was. And then just there was a point when I just my whole thinking changed about what it is to be teaching, because I started to think, you know, I'm not. This is like that difference where Thich Nhat Hanh says, you know, you're not washing the dishes to get them clean. You're washing the dishes just to wash the dishes. So I started feeling like I'm not teaching to get the information across. I'm just teaching to teach.
Mm.
And it just was such a different feeling. It's hard to, I don't know if it gets across, because for me internally, yeah. I was teaching the same basic material, but I think my teaching style changed. But also I just felt like there was like a new tunnel. It just widened up. I thought, you know, I'm going to go here and I'm going to teach this and I'm going to teach it like I've never taught it. I'm going to teach the same material, but God knows what's going to come out of my mouth. And it was so different, and it still is. I'm still sort of in that tunnel at this point. And I look back on that while we were thinking about tonight, and how did that happen? You know, I mean, is that a set of circumstances that just is so random and chance that you couldn't reproduce it, or is there a sort of a lesson there?
Yeah.
About how this came about, because it really lengthened and transformed my teaching to be kind of the tunnel just feels very wide. So I don't know, you know, I didn't go through specifically the exercises you're talking about, but I have a feeling that it was something like that. And the first key was I just hung in there.
Yeah. Where when you started to have an experience that you couldn't explain, you stayed with it. And then it sounds like you went with it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm talking about that actual moment when you had that experience standing up teaching and she's teaching and talking with you.
Yeah.
I think that right there, as opposed to shutting that down, that's what I was talking about earlier, this ability to trust emergence. So, like, right as you're in that experience, you have the skills to stay with it.
And right. Well, I did at that moment. That's true.
Yeah. I think that that takes a lot of courage. That's not I think that there's a habit we all have of when it gets that strange, when it gets that uncomfortable, when it's that just unpredictable, we escape into our old habits. And instead, you stayed with it. And then it got really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
It really opened up. It transformed. Bill Miller talks about this. There's a book by him and C. DeBaca. I can't remember her first name right now. About quantum change. Have you read that?
No.
Yeah, it's a really...
It's Bill or Miller of Motivational Interviewing.
Exactly. One of his other interests has been he and the other author interviewed all these people who have had these radical changes, sort of insights or awakenings. And they weren't all spiritual. Many of the people were not religious, you know, didn't have particular spiritual beliefs. Mm-hmm. But they had these moments where, you know, they talk about it in AA as like hitting bottom, but it wasn't just around substance use. It could be around other types of things where there was a quantum change. It wasn't this kind of incremental, you know, but more like what you were just describing, where things changed in a very kind of radical way.
Yeah, but
what's really cool about that book is they just give the accounts of different people. I think they're like 50-some-odd who were recruited, and they just told their stories about these experiences of quantum change. And then at the end, they offer some, just a lot of different possibilities in terms of explanations about why this is. It's a lot like, in some ways, it's like William James's book, you know, Varieties of Religious Experience, except more contemporary. But it has some of the elements that you were just talking about, this sort of, you know, you're on a trajectory, many things are accumulating, then there's this instant in which things are transformed. Is that fit for you?
No, I think that's exactly, because I think that when you have what is quantum change, it is kind of a different metaphor would be, it's like an earthquake where when there's an earthquake, it's this sudden change, and it rearranges the earth, but it really has been coming for quite a while, and it's the result of a long buildup of, you know, tension between two vectors, and there are some adjustments made along the way, and then an earthquake happens, and you say, oh, it's quantum change, but you know what? It's quantum change that's intimately connected to all the previous steps.
Yeah.
And, you know, for instance, I don't think I would have gone to Stockholm or anywhere else probably and had that kind of experience. First, I think it helps actually, and it might be one of the clues here, is that it was a different place.
Mm-hmm.
Even the fact that, you know, I think a lot of people have experiences when you go to another country or another culture, you just wake up to some things about your own. You might go back and change things, and you might not, but there are these moments. So I think it actually, that idea is probably one of the things that helps, but also the fact that there's been a kind of a growing pressure or tension or discontent sort of sets the stage for some sort of little earthquake. And then where you go with that, you know, do you now follow that? You kind of pay attention to that and extend it in a way, or try it out, or include it. You know, it could be a new tunnel.
Yeah, I think for some people, these sort of more transformational or sudden insights, it's not even like you have a choice. I think that was the other thing that was real interesting about this book, Quantum Change. When epiphanies and sudden insights transform ordinary lives, sometimes the people don't have any choice about they just are changed. It's like immediately the stimulus are changed. And they studied, one of the things that they talk about is, are these sorts of insights long-lasting, or are they kind of ephemeral? They fade away. And it turns out they're both. And it was really interesting to read about why one way versus another. But one of the common things they found across it was this sort of decrease in an increase in what you would call spirituality or personal peace or loving. And when you're describing this shift in yourself, this shift to being of service or teaching for teaching's sake, I think that's a really interesting way that what you're describing seems similar to what Miller and C. DeBacco were talking about.
I'll tie it to popular culture. I was flying back on the plane today from Los Angeles, and I was watching a thing on the TV, the screen there, and it was an interview in Actors Studio, if you've ever watched Actors Studio, with Brad Pitt. And he was asking Brad Pitt about what his style as an actor is when he's doing a take, and then you have to do another take of the same scene and another take and all those takes. And they were saying that Jack Nicholson has always been known as a guy who every time he does another take, he does it totally differently. He's always been that way. So he doesn't go back and try to do the take again the correct way. Like he'll do a take again, and then he does it. He just comes at it as if he's never done it. And then Pitt was saying that that's what he tries to do also. But there are other people who just keep trying to get it right. And I think that there is something about that. I mean, that can go off. That can be dysfunctional in some contexts. But I think that's partly what we're talking about here, is there's this. I mean, for me, the teaching is, I might, like this weekend, I taught topics I've taught repeatedly. But I was mostly focused on the teaching commitment from a dialectical standpoint, or teaching, you know, targeting from a dialectical standpoint, teaching validation from a dialectical standpoint. And what I meant by all of that was, I mean, I just kept coming up with things and tried to turn it this way and this way. And to me, that makes it just so much more interesting for me. I mean, sometimes the problem with that is somebody actually needs to start out with just getting the basics. It might not meet everybody's needs, but as a teacher, and I sort of think, what if you're in a relationship and you feel that the relationship has gotten filled with a lot of routines? And the routines are just not that, you know, they're not working that. Now you just know these are the routines. This is what we do. It's kind of like, how would you apply that, I mean, to those situations where you're trying to, you know, do a different take every time? Or come at it with awareness and deliberately not doing the same. I mean, there must be a lot of practical suggestions. So I want to look at that Miller book and look also at Gregory Kramer's thing. But I would like to take this, really, and not just let it drop at the end of this hour, and take it and be thinking. Because the patients I work with in therapy and the people I supervise and people I consult to, I think you could really apply all of this. And I mean, how do you help people step out of these patterns? I mean, because the ones I described kind of came up, the one in me obviously just came up. I didn't deliberately cultivate it.
Yeah.
But the question is, if you did want to create the conditions for this, like the insight therapy dialogue, that might be one of them.
Well, you know, the other, Charlie, I was thinking a lot about is people who get out of interpersonal violence. I think the research is that it takes up to 7 tries before finally on the 8th try you get out. You know,
out of what? Interpersonal violence? You mean being the perpetrator or the victim of that?
The victim.
Uh-huh.
And so I was thinking when you were just saying that, this way in which it's like an earthquake on the one hand, but it's like a series of small changes, and the number of times you might have to make a run at something before you really, you know, like an orbit in a planet practically, where you're circling, and then finally you get enough momentum to get out, or conditions have changed enough to produce the more quantum change.
I like that perspective a lot.
Yeah, that one can do that, you know, that these little changes that really do add up, you know, getting, like I'm just thinking about domestic violence again, you know, getting a job, getting so that you have your own income, strengthening some of the friendships, you know, really working out the safety plan, all the various, making sure the kids are safe. There's like so many different details that have to kind of fall into place before you can really escape.
But it's hard to be patient with oneself.
And
being what?
It's hard to be patient with oneself and others with the rate of change.
Yeah, if you have a close friend and she's caught in a violent relationship and you want her out and you try to support that, and then she gets out and then you learn on the weekend she's back in.
Yeah.
And then she tries again and she's back in. I think the important thing there that I think can catalyze change is to actually appreciate that every one of those efforts is actually, it's a new take.
Yeah.
And that in that new take, you may have learned another thing.
Exactly.
And that, you know, you may, like you say, it may take like, you know, running and jumping 7 or 8 or 9 times before you can put it all together. But it's important. That's an important perspective for not getting discouraged. I supervised somebody last year who was telling me about someone she was working with who was caught in a variety of patterns in her life, interpersonally and with illness and with her own self-concept, where she just was stuck. Someone who used to really think of her life as going very different. And once she started to get a chronic connective tissue disease, it just didn't get better, and it was stuck. And then there was a certain point when they started talking almost as if it was an aside from the therapy, but it became the most important moment. They talked about something she always had wanted to do. I won't say what it is just to reduce the identifiability, but it was an activity that she hadn't ever done. And so they just started focusing on, why don't you do that? And then the therapist pushed her to do that. And then she went and did that. And from that perspective, it was like going to Sweden. It was like things looked different. Things looked possible. So in a way, she, just by finding one thing to do that was breaking the old pattern and in a way exposing herself to something she had avoided, it didn't just change that. It really started to give her hope. So I think a turning point, I mean, if she continues to transform her own life in the direction she started to do, I think the turning point's going to be that moment, you know, somewhere in there, at least one of the turning points, that they had that conversation, and then she went actually and did that activity one time after a lot of angst about doing it.
Yeah.
All my friends are going to think I'm ridiculous. Oh, nobody's going to want to do it with me. All of this stuff. And then the therapist had to kind of become the advocate once they both agreed that it's probably a good idea. Hey, Kelly, we're going to get to the end of the call in a couple minutes, and you said there was another tributary or of your thinking about this that wasn't the direction I went. And I did you already bring it in, or was there a different direction you went
just to
say another word about it?
Well, so I'll offer it. I'm not sure if it would be useful or not, but just to say it. I just came back from the Association for Contextual Behavioral Science conference, and one of the people I heard talk was a guy named Todd Kasdan, and he does really interesting research. And one of the points he was making was how much it matters. Like, so if you think we're making up explanations, we're deciding where to truncate, you know, okay, so this was a turning point. Okay, wait. No, it was 5 minutes before or 5 days. You know, like, where we divide this stream is somewhat arbitrary. You know, it's a story. Mm-hmm. And what he was talking about is how much the story might change depending on when you ask. And this turns out to have some pretty important points if you're going to actually do research. Like, if, for example, when you said earlier, so how could you actually facilitate people making these turning points? You'd want to research it. You'd like to want to study it. Well, it turns out the typical ways we do research don't fit very well for the natural trajectory of how perceptions change. And Todd gave an example of he just had a child. I guess the kiddo is 6 or 9 months or something like that. And he said, you know, if you'd asked him right after the birth, what was that experience like, and then he were to describe it, it would have been awe. It was not his first child. Kind of awe, and there was, I think, some other descriptive words he put in there. And then if you'd asked him a week or two later, it would have been sort of more polished and shiny and positive. And then if you asked him a year later about that, it would actually be different still. Because, you know, by then probably the marital dissatisfaction that kicks in with all the birth of all little ones would have kicked in. So, you know, there's a slight arbitrary nature to how we define these and how we rate their valence, and that's time sensitive. So the other thought I was having about all of this is this ability to hold it lightly, to hold our explanation of events somewhat lightly, knowing that how we explain it, how we divide it, things will change. Does that make sense, or what do you think about that?
Oh, I think that makes complete sense. It makes it very complicated.
Yeah.
Because, you know, this, I remember, at one point, I think Liz Simpson was doing this kind of project for herself and maybe for teaching and learning purposes about doing behavioral chain analysis. And she was being the patient and going around and having different expert DBT therapists do the behavioral chain on the exact same incident.
Oh, interesting.
And even there, each chain came out, even though she had a very clear and detailed story in her head of what had happened, every chain came out very different.
Oh, that's really interesting.
So it really, I mean, just to hear that, even though I wasn't even part of that, I just heard that and I thought, I totally believe that. I know that that's true, but I don't stop and think about it. And if you really were trying to study how, you know, a story goes, look at how you do have to take it as important and as light. I mean, it's really important in the moment because it is your current at the moment representation of your story. And it's real. That's what it is right then. But even 10 minutes later, your story about the birth of your child, it might be a very
different
story.
And what if you lived your life influenced knowing that? I think that's what I was talking about earlier about somehow getting a little free of the storyline. If you really accept that, or if you directly experience it because of, like you did with Liz's story of really seeing that.
Yeah.
But I think if you really have that experience, then in some ways it frees you up. To me, it actually expands it makes some of the walls of the tunnel drop away. I think that, for me at least, that's another way of getting that some of this verbal, the story.
Well, I think partly the walls of the tunnel are made up of the storyline.
Exactly.
And the way you've told the story, the way you keep telling yourself the story.
Yeah.
And it, once you get settled on a sort of a chronically consistent story, it creates walls that'll be very different if every day you just told the same story and it was a different story. It's like, okay, now I might not just have a different story, but I might pursue a different avenue today about how I might do a totally different take on this story. I'll just say, well, it's 9 o'clock, I think, but I don't know if you ever saw the movie, but right up this alley, if you ever want to Netflix it or find it somewhere, if you haven't seen it, it's called The Thin Blue Line.
Oh, I haven't seen that.
The Thin Blue Line is about the police, and it's about it's all focused on one incident where they stop some, I don't even remember the details of it, but they stop, two policemen stop a car, and they go and they deal with the people in the car, and it becomes, I think, a real confrontational event. And then it presents it, and then it goes back and it presents it again from a slightly different angle, the exact same incident, like several times, over and over again, until you're thinking, wow, I have no idea what happened here. I can't trust anybody's story, and I think that's partly what this is, to not get despairing about that, just take it lightly. But
yeah, well,
who knew we would end up at this This is interesting to me. Maybe we'll think about where this goes for our next talk.
Well, so it brings me back to your patient, you know, the one you began
with. The guy?
Yeah, because if I think about him, the way that you, if that's true, if it could be any story, then if you reconnect with your values, if you can somehow get in touch with that more, you know, at this junction in this tunnel, the place, there's some air, you know.
Yeah. Light. Yeah, you start to realize, okay, well, that's just this story.
Yeah.
And how but about, let's try a different story.
Into, if you, I feel like at your guy you were describing, you can feel where the air and the light are in the direction that.
Oh, you could. Just in talking with him, you could start to just see it in his eyes. Like,
and then you
can
make
tell.
That step. Like, and in fact, the story is optional, is really what I feel like. If there's something about.
Mm-hmm.
It was something about that process that you guys did,
mm-hmm.
of the exploring and the finding where, you know, where there is air, where there is light, that you know, you can take steps in that direction. You can kind of feel which way to go.
Mm-hmm. And he was ready to go, which is another factor.
Yeah.
Hey, look, we should stop, but I know Perry had a question. Perry had a question about whether we'll be doing these into the fall. I have assumed that we would, but we haven't laid out dates. And I don't know, Kelly, if you're on the same page about this.
Oh, definitely.
Wonderful.
I think we can connect with you about dates, and it sounds like we need to soon because you're sort of getting other things set up. But I think I think the end of August, which would be a month from now, would not work. I just know I'm going to be out the last 2 weeks of August. So we're going to be looking at September for the next one, and then maybe try to get back on close to a monthly track.
Oh, that would be terrific. Well, maybe the three of us can be on email and come up with the dates that work for both of you. But we're so grateful. I'm so grateful to hear that you want to continue, because I just find these talks wonderful.
Ah, well, I'm taking them now the way I was saying I'm taking the teaching. These are talks just to have a talk. It makes it, I mean, it's to have a talk with Kelly. And hopefully it's of interest to people. But also, just while people are on the line, if they still are, it would be great if they email you, Perry, and just give any feedback or to the website, so that we just get an idea of how they're being received.
Okay, I think that's great. Yes, and for those of you who are willing, please do send it to neabpd@aol.com.
And any suggestions.
I'm sorry?
And any suggestions of ideas, things to talk about.
But Kelly and Charlie, I think there's a paper in what you did tonight.
Mm.
I don't know. I mean, the way you both brought these two concepts together in a way that was so meaningful. I don't know if you know, because you were doing it, if you can appreciate how they just sort of merge together in something so, I think, helpful, both for individuals who are doing therapy and those people who, you know, would like to sort of change their own perspective on things.
Mm-hmm.
That's it.
Well, I'm so glad you archived these, and then I've gone back and listened to one of them a few weeks ago and found it interesting to hear it, since when you're having it, it's not the same as when you hear it later.
Right, yeah. Exactly. Yes, they're all recorded for forever.
Great.
Right. So
don't say that.
I'm glad we've got the Lone Ranger on there personally.
I'm going to have to mind my language.
All right. We'll be on email for dates, and
yeah.
Thank you so much, and have a wonderful August.
Okay.
Kelly
will be in touch this week about other things, okay?
Bye-bye.
All right, guys. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.